This podcast is brought to you by the Legatum Institute. I'm Sian Hansen, Executive Director, and we hope you enjoy this lecture.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the Legatum Institute. My name is Alexandra Musavisadeh, and I'm the Director of the Prosperity Index. And for those who do not know the Institute, we are a global think tank, and our mission is to identify and promote the drivers of prosperity around the world. The Prosperity Index is our signature publication, which ranks 142 countries in terms of their wealth and well-being, and is now in its 10th year. Our understanding of prosperity goes beyond GDP and includes 8 additional pillars, which range from education and health, to social capital and personal freedoms, to governance and entrepreneurship and safety and security. Our Africa Prosperity Report slices out the data from the Global Prosperity Index and measures and tracks the progress made in the region. It identifies barriers to prosperity and develops policy recommendations based on these findings. With us to discuss some of those findings and to launch our third annual report on prosperity in Africa, we are delighted to have Lord Mark Maddock-Brown, the former UN Deputy Secretary General and former head of UNDP. Most of you will be familiar with Mark's distinguished record as a passionate and results-oriented global advocate for African development. But welcome, Mark. We're delighted to have you. Thank you very much.
Well, Alexandra, thank you very much. And thank you for all the work on behalf of all of us that have gone into this report, and Augustine as well. I mean, it is a wonderful, extraordinary index. I think it won't surprise you that as an ex-head of UNDP, I slightly tease Alexandra about its similarities to the UNDP Human Development Index, but she promptly corrects me by pointing out the very important additional things that have been added, the focus on entrepreneurship and on opportunity, the more explicit references to governance, and measurements of government in, governance in the index, and that critical thing of social capital. So it is, you know, very much in a sense an index which captures the current development debates in a way that perhaps the HDI did in its time, but now needs to, as the grandfather of such indexes, needs to look to this new generation and could, I suspect, learn some things by, from what the Prosperity Education Index has done, because the HDI is much more based on health and education, GDP, and a freedom measure that doesn't get into some of the other things that I've mentioned. But I think what in London at the moment, speaking about a report like this is in some ways the most refreshing thing of all. It's, you know, for months in this town, it's been almost impossible to have a discussion of development without it coming down to the 0.7 target. And the glory of this report is it's not really about aid. It's about the different performances of African governments to achieve this prosperity. And, you know, for some of them, there is quite a high degree of aid dependence. But for others who are doing incredibly well, there's almost no aid dependence at all as a proportion of the economy. So it kind of just happily moves the debate on to performance and results on the ground. And, you know, congratulations for that, because that's, I think, where we should all be. But I am, you know, in a sense, I think as a friend, immediate friend of her report, I am going to just pick a little at some of the findings. And, you know, one of them is Rwanda, which does incredibly well in this report, and very properly, because, you know, I during my years at UNDP was one of those who was astonished at the speed with which Kagame's Rwanda came back on indicators like health and education, you know, very quickly overtook the numbers before the genocide and continued year on year to demonstrate real improvements. So in a way, no surprise that in a prosperity index, which is trying to measure in one regard the gap between per capita income and real performance in bringing prosperity to citizens, no surprise Rwanda's success compared to, for example, a much wealthier country of Angola, you know, which ranks 33rd to Rwanda's 8th in the prosperity index. But then you look at the breakdown of Rwanda's indicators, and you see that it gets third in the continent for governance. And, you know, that's quite a mouthful to swallow, because even if, like me, you know, I'm actually rather a fan of President Kagame's development achievements, I wince at the government costs of that in terms of the nature of the political regime. So, you know, I do think, you know, the bias towards economic governance at the expense of political governance that I suspect that result reflects is something I think we should pick up as we go on. But I think really, in a way, what this report so well does is prepares us for the next phase of the Africa story, because we are evidently into a phase where growth rates are moderating in Africa. This happy 5.5% average for the last decade that we've all got so familiar at quoting isn't the story going forward. It's going to be a couple of points off that in the coming years. And that's obviously because of the crisis of commodity prices, which has had a knock-on effect on levels of foreign direct investment, commitments to infrastructure development, et cetera, et cetera. West Africa is littered with stalled projects, infrastructure which is not completed, from railways to ports, et cetera. But it's not just a story of West Africa. You're seeing much the same happening in parts of East Africa and in Mozambique, et cetera, as well. So this is a region which has got to grapple with a challenge of lower growth. And, you know, what does the report have to tell us about the way forward? And the first obvious point is its prosperity index, that GDP is not the only guide to the well-being of its citizens. You can, through good government policy and the provision of things like health and education and opportunity and freedom, make sure your citizens perform much better and have a much better life than GDP alone would suggest. So the power of government and good policy to direct and influence results remain thoroughly unabated. The second issue, though, is, you know, what I think you could call commodities versus complex. The commodities being the Angolas and Nigerias, who are heavily dependent on the export of one unrefined commodity, oil, versus those economies which have had either the opportunity or have worked at building complexity into their economies, particularly making sure that the value added to their exports is more than just one step. It's often a process of having to import other inputs, but the final export that goes out leaves a lot more value added in the economy behind. And so complexity or diversification of an economy is a key finding in this report in terms of equipping yourself for the future going forward. And then I think the next and critical issue is this point of freedom. The assertion in the report, and those of you familiar with the work of the Legatum Institute won't be surprised, the assertion that freedom leads to prosperity. Freer people are more economically successful, and I profoundly believe this. I at UNDP, you know, rather controversially created a good governance and democracy practice, because, you know, I think freer people are better entrepreneurs, better economic agents, but I also think the freedom to choose your governments leads to more accountable government and therefore a more effective attack on poverty. The next point that I think the report also makes is that we can talk about freedom and we can talk about entrepreneurs and we can talk about economic diversification, but we cannot forget the continuing challenge of basic needs in African economies. Still some 50% of the population are falling short of, you know, what you might call the threshold basic needs platform. You know, in Nigeria, for example, the level of sanitation provision is the same as in Afghanistan, despite the fact Nigeria is a country three times richer in per capita terms than Afghanistan. And, you know, these issues of both dealing with the basic challenges but liberating people to be economic agents of their own destiny and their country's destiny is absolutely critical in a region which is the only one in the world whose population will double in size in little more than a generation. You know, we are not fitting out Africa for the kind of stabilizing population that is now the story in many parts of Asia. We have to kit out Africa, or Africa has to kit itself out, rather, you know, for the prospect of high levels of demographic growth. And the challenge in some ways is quite stark. Workers and consumers versus dependents and migrants. And that is a policy challenge which, if we get the answer wrong, will affect not just those on the continent, but in coming generations, Europe and any other region which comes close to Africa. So it's a huge, huge challenge. And therefore, looking forward, what is the model which is going to create the jobs and the opportunity and the real livelihoods for this demographic explosion that Africa is in the midst of? And African sort of businessman, economist, academic, who you may all be familiar with, or many of you, Kingsley Moghalu, who, a Nigerian, you know, has been insisting in a book he's written and in many speeches in London and elsewhere, on the industrialization of Africa. You know, a concept which I must say I'm a bit wary of, because I think, in a sense, that is a very 19th century or 20th century solution. And I'm not sure the furnaces of Manchester or is something that one wants to wish on any countries who have this ahead. And if indeed, if you look to history, you know, in some ways, fixing Africa's agriculture should precede even a discussion about industrialization. And that is both the world of commercial and of small farmers. And the inputs and investments to create an efficient, effective agricultural sector, and one that, you know, is able to sustain the land on which it farms, is an absolutely critical current challenge. But with it comes what kind of urbanization is the continent going to embark on? And at the moment, it's a rather giddy and unmanaged one, with, you know, an explosion of both city size and the number of cities of significant plus a million population or more. And so the question of quality urbanization, which is right and tailored to the continent and its needs, and indeed to different regions of the continent, is critical. So if I was to sort of think of what are the characteristics which might define Africa as we go forward, it would first be, you know, a appropriate kind of urbanization, which is neither the rigid city planning of other regions, but nor is it the completely unplanned profusion of growth that we are currently seeing. It would be a development where the issue of renewables and off-grid power and generally decentralized solutions to a lot of problems of the continent and of countries would be very large indeed. It would be a development where a modern kind of services sector, where Africa has been, you know, a real leader with, just to take the two most totemic names we all know in the sector, of M-Pesa with its mobile banking capability, but also M-Kopa with its solar power for which you pay over your mobile phone. This whole idea of mobile commerce, which is so much an African-led and Kenyan-led, particularly innovation, is one that I think we'll see a lot more of as we go forward. And that's not to say there won't be industrialization. Involved with a company in Kenya, which is trying to fabricate some of the oil plants that at the moment get dragged from Korea or occasionally from South Africa to offshore locations off Nigeria, but we're actually increasingly the skills and capability to make them locally and use local content are in place. So I think, you know, the development and the job creation in the continent is very much going to follow its own pattern. There's no, you know, European or American or Asian model from which it's going to borrow wholesale. The countries of Africa will find their own way forward. And just, you know, a final word, which is around the private sector component of this growth, because I do think, you know, you just can't make the sums add up unless you attract large amounts of private capital to the continent, along with the innovation and know-how and business models which make that capital effective, whether it's building out the infrastructure, both energy and transport, and the new urbanization requirements, or finding the investment for agriculture. That is a major capital deficit that can only be plugged by the private sector. But with that prospect of winning investment into Africa comes the need for sound, transparent legal frameworks and redress for the investor who feels that they've been wrongly done by. And I do think that some of the minerals investments in the Congo, the oil and gas in West Africa, there's a sorry story still to be finished of, you know, investments where there was corruption at the core of them, which is going to cast quite a shadow over the investment climate in many parts of the continent in the coming few years, as American investors get dragged into it through their Department of Justice. And, you know, there's a general sort of anxiety about the exposure and risk to African investments, in particularly the commodities sector. But let me say that said, that capital's got to come. There is no way around it. But I think equally as it comes, it is critical that it is capital which is much more long-term patient capital than in the past, much more respectful of local rule of law issues, and much more transparent, much more committed to being a good citizen. And that, you know, today still we are seeing governments surprised by, you know, illegal loans that have been taken out by companies that have somehow secured a government guarantee, whether it's the current loan in for defense loan in Mozambique, which the VTB Bank, you know, feels it's owed by the central government. Some of the issues of the Eurobond borrowings in Ghana. I mention those two countries because both have been poster boys for foreign investment in the continent, and yet both now are struggling with illicit debts that are bearing directly on the country's capacity to meet its obligations to its citizens and sustain growth. So I hope, both on the side of government in the continent, but also on the side of those who step up to meet this private sector investment gap, that there is, you know, a real sense of responsibility and shared commitment to the strategic choice the continent faces of workers and consumers versus migrants and dependency. And, you know, that really is the extraordinary choice, historic choice, that I think we all face in dealing with this remarkable continent that so many of us have either been born in or devoted our working lives to. Thank you very much.
To hear more podcasts from the Legatum Institute, please visit our iTunes channel or website at www.li.com.